Today's Teisho will be on case 34 in the Heikigan Roku, the PN Lu. Case 34 is entitled Kyozans, You Have Not Visited Rozan. Main subject, Kyozan asked a monk, where are you from? Mount Rozan, answered the monk. Have you ever visited Goroho Peak? Asked Kyozan. No, not yet, said the monk. Kyozan said, you have not visited Rozan. Later, Ulmon said, this talk of Kyozan's was falling into the weeds out of kindness. Secho's verse, falling or not falling, who can tell? White clouds piling up, bright sun shining down. Faultless the left, mature the right. Don't you know Kanzan? He went very fast, 10 years not returning. He forgot the way he had come. So I want to thank everybody for being here and for practicing so wholeheartedly and for sitting so well this morning. It's really wonderful, these long sits in the morning, just really nothing like it. And everybody's sitting so still, it's wonderful. So this koan is really important, I think. It sounds like a conversation, an ordinary conversation. It was often the case in a Zen tradition that when a new monk would come to the temple, he would eventually meet the teacher there. So basically, there's a new monk, and Kyozan is the teacher. And Kyozan asks the monk a question, and it's a practical question, and it's a Zen question. He says, where are you from? And the monk says, Mount Rozan, which was like a, Mount Rozan was like at one time in Zen, in Chinese Buddhism, was a very important place. There were lots of temples there. There was a lot of Dharma activity. And he says, where have you been? I'm from Mount Rozan, answered the monk. He says, have you ever been to Goroho Peak? The monk says, not yet. And he says, you have not visited Rozan. Okay, so he says, I'm from Rozan. He says, well, you're from, it's like saying, I'm from Colorado. Have you seen this mountain? Well, then you're not, you know, you haven't been to Colorado yet, right? Basically, that's the idea. So you've been to Seattle, have you seen Mount Rainier? No, not yet. Well, then you haven't been to Seattle. See, that's the spirit of that exchange. We've initiated once again our sutra study. It's been very enjoyable so far. We've just gotten started. And the first sutra we read is one of the ones that I think most important. It's part of the Pali Canon, and it's called the Sutra of the Noble Search. And in the Sutra of the Noble Search, the Buddha talks about how he got on the path, how he became the Buddha, and what that involved. He relates the whole story in response to some monks who ask him, how did this all happen? You know, what prompted you to pursue awakening and so on? And the Buddha tells them his story. And one of the most interesting things about the account, in my opinion, is that, you know, the Buddha left home in pursuit of awakening, And he studied with two of the foremost meditation masters of his day, Alara Kalama and Udraka Ramaputra. And both of them were considered like deeply awake. And the Buddha went to study with one of them and mastered the technique that that teacher had to present. And then the Buddha said, you know, I really mastered that technique, but I didn't think it was truly enlightenment. And then he left, even though that teacher, Udraka Ramaputra, said, look, why don't you stay here? You've mastered this technique, teach with me. And the Buddha said, no, I'm sorry, I don't think you really have it. I don't think this is enlightenment. And then he goes to Alara Kalama and same thing. And then the Buddha goes off on his own. One of the things the Buddha says when he talks about studying with these two teachers is, he said, it's not just that I could recite, you know, chapter and verse of what they said. It's that in my body and my mind, I had been there. I had experienced it at the deepest level of my being. See? And I think that's so much what we're about here in Zen. You know, Zen comes along in Buddhist history almost 1600 years after the death of the Buddha. So Zen is not like an early development of Buddhism. And it wasn't even the first school of Buddhism to take root in China. You know, Buddhism started coming into China around the beginning of the Common Era, like around years one, right? And you know, basically Buddhism happens really, 1600 years is a little conservative, probably like 1800 years begins to take off. And I always think of Zen as a kind of rebellion against established Buddhism, you know? So by the time Weinong had received the teachings from his teacher back to Bodhidharma, Buddhism was already flourishing, and there were temples and there were monasteries and convents. There were like libraries. There were Dharma speakers. There were big people would address big crowds, and there, you know, there were lots of people who knew Buddhism intellectually really well, and they could tell you all about the Dharmakaya and the Trikaya, and they could tell you about they knew the Lankavatara, or they knew the Diamond Sutra backwards and forward. But I think Zen is kind of a protest against that, right? Because it's saying that isn't really knowing. That's not really knowing. You know, it's very important to read the sutras. That's why we have our study group, and I urge you to join. If you're interested at all in Buddhist thinking. And I think it's very important. It's really important to study the sutras, not a problem. But studying the sutras, reading Buddhist literature and so on, reading books on Buddhist thinking, there's all kinds of brilliant books on Buddhist thinking. You know, reading those books is like reading a travel guide, right? And reciting the sutras is like reciting a travel guide Even, you know, ceremonies, you know, ceremonies, some of you may be familiar with the sand sculpture, the beautiful sand designs that Tibetan Buddhists do, right? You know, they have a ceremony where they make a mandala out of sand, and it takes them days and days, right? It's very much like meditation in itself. They have these little funnels, little tiny funnels that let out like one or two grains of sand. And they tap it. First of all, they have a design and they sort of sketch it out, and then they fill it in with colored sand. And they're incredibly complicated, and they take days and days to do. And then at the end of the process, they take a broom and sweep it all away. But you know, even that is just a map. Mandala is just a map, actually, right? So you know, when the Buddha made this distinction between, he said, I knew intellectually everything they taught, and I didn't just know it intellectually, I knew it in my body and in the depths of my body-mind, right? That's real knowing. That's like not reading the travel guide, but going to the place, right? Going to the place. So, you know, many years ago, I had a dear friend, Sharmini Mukherjee. And she she practiced with our group, and her husband, Pradeep Mukherjee, practiced with our group. And I had wonderful experiences with the Sri Lankan community. And, you know, it was marvelous to see a community that, you know, basically people grew up in a Buddhist milieu, right? In a Buddhist world, you could say. I didn't grow up in a Buddhist world. I grew up in the United States. My parents weren't Buddhists. I got interested in Buddhism, and I've come to Buddhism as somebody who wasn't born into that heritage, right? And it was so it was wonderful to see that community. You know. They used to invite me to teach meditation sometimes, and I would go over there and teach meditation. And I had a wonderful experience for many years, but one time I was invited to an event, and we did some meditation, and somebody said to me, he said, why are we doing this? I mean, this really happened. It was like a public event. They were having one of these full moon days. And we were meditating, and somebody said, why are we doing this? And I said, what do you mean? What do you mean, why are we meditating? And he said, why do we have to do this? We're not monks, right? And he wasn't being combative. I think he was honestly confused. It was like, we have the teachings, right? We have the teachings. The teachings have been passed down from the Buddha to us. We have the suttas. We can read the suttas. We have these traditions, these wonderful traditions. Why do we have? The Buddha had to do this, but why do we have to do this? See? And I think that was such an interesting question. And by the way, I wasn't eloquent and able to persuade everybody. I would say that there was a kind of wall of incomprehension, actually. You know, I think Zen is a protest against that wall of incomprehension. Zen is saying, you know, studying the sutras is like reading a travel guide, And going to the country is doing what we're doing. You know, so when the Buddha talked about how he achieved enlightenment, he did not say that he achieved enlightenment by reading the foremost thinkers of his day. He achieved enlightenment by sitting on a cushion for hours and hours and days and days and days, and working through the layers of his consciousness. Right. And in our sutra study group, we've been looking at some of those early sutras and the jhanas that the Buddha passes through. And in Zen, we don't teach the jhanas, but you know, I think Zen is very much like a protest against just holding on to the travel books. You know, and saying, well, you know, we have the travel books. We don't have to go to the country. We have them. And we know they're reliable. We trust them. So why do we have to go? But I think Zen is a protest, and Zen is saying, wait, if you, what good are the travel books if you aren't going? See, and the Buddha himself said, you know, the world honored one himself said, you know, I didn't just listen to what these people taught. I, you know, sat on a cushion and went into deep shunyata, deep emptiness. And then I could judge for myself the truth of what they said or the limits of what they said. See, so you know, I think this is so wonderful. And, you know, Zen, I think, saved Buddhism in China. Because, you know, I think Buddhism was becoming routinized and perfunctory. You know, if somebody dies, you know, there's many different ways to respond to somebody dying. Charmini, my wonderful friend, had scleroderma. I don't know if you know what scleroderma is, but it's a terrible disease. It's just really terrible. It's where your tissues start to die while you're still alive. It may be an autoimmune response. It's not fully understood. But, you know, basically people develop scleroderma and organs begin to be attacked by your own body and they die. So Charmini was this really remarkable person who came from Sri Lanka and got a PhD and worked, I believe, for Colgate-Palmolive. She's a scientist, very smart. And she had two sons and a lovely family. And then she began to deteriorate. And, you know, they actually, her lungs, she got scleroderma in her lungs. And then, you know, she lived much longer than anybody suspected it was possible to do. And she meditated quite regularly. I used to go over to her house and she meditated on her own. And she also had this wonderful Chinese doctor who kept her Western doctor said, whatever this guy is doing, keep doing it, because I can't believe you're still alive. But you know, when she died, that was a big ceremony for her. And you know, it's complicated when somebody dies. You know, one way to deal with it is to say, ah, this is impermanence. So many people in Charmini's circle, when they learned about her dying, said, ah, this is impermanence. No, the Buddha said, the Lord said, you know, we are all composite things must fall apart. And we're composite things, and we fall apart. And so it's just as the Lord Buddha said, right? But you know, actually, that's a That's an interesting response, because what you're doing is you're actually pushing death away. You're using, I would say, you're using the Dharma to create a wall between you and the event. And you're holding the event at bay. See? So when somebody dies, you can preserve your peace of mind by saying, ah, all is impermanent. This is just what it says in the guidebook, right? This is just what it says in the guidebook. See, but Zen is a protest against that. It says, let's explore, what does it mean to die? See, what is death? Why are we worried about, let's not retreat from death. What is death? What is birth? See? So, you know, there's a very famous story about a Zen master who got back to the temple, and his teacher had just died, and he just started sobbing. And this monk sees him, and the monk comes up and says, "What kind of Zen master are you? You know, you're supposed to be an awakened being. Your teacher has died and you're sobbing." And the monk turns and says, "Listen, when I want to sob, I'll sob." And you know, we could imagine a fully enlightened person as responding to the death of his teacher with total calm. But you know, how do you know that's the right response? And what is death anyway, right? So I think you can kind of see where I'm going with this, is that one way we can use the Dharma is as a road map or a guidebook. But if we want to, you know, if we have this spirit of like, go yourself, go there yourself, it's a totally different way of traveling. Because we're not going to try to avoid anything. Right? We're not going to try to avoid anything. We're going to go into it all ourselves, just like we were the Buddha. Right? So, you know, basically, what is death? What is death? You know, we think we know what death is. You know, and you can read scientists, you know, how long does the brain survive, you know, this is all, what does it mean to experience death? See, and I really respect that Zen master who started sobbing when his teacher died. In other words, he's not afraid to experience sorrow. It's not like sorrow is something that will destroy our awakened mind. He's not afraid of experiencing loss. Right? What is loss anyway? What is sorrow anyway? So, you know, Zen is really a profound teaching. It says it's protesting against routinization of, you know, Buddhism. So, you know, you can go to a temple and you can light incense in the altar. Yeah, or outside the temple. Usually in Chinese temples, there's a big, big giant incense burner. And you could put sticks of incense in there. And you could go into the Buddha hall and you can prostrate yourself, you know, 108 times in front of the Buddha. But what are you really doing? You know, actually, I don't think those practices enlighten you, if I may say so. You know, I think that the way to enlightenment is what we're doing. I think that devotion is a very necessary element to our practice, but devotion is not wisdom, right? It's not wisdom. Devotion helps us on the path to wisdom, but it's not wisdom. So you know, Zen is about is this protest against a formalization. You know, people will say, I'm going on a pilgrimage. They go on a pilgrimage and they prostrate themselves 108 times each time they get to a temple. Are they doing anything or not? You know, are they doing anything or not? Does this have anything to do with encountering your Buddha nature face to face? See, and it's an open question, but at least we're asking the question. So Zen comes along and it says, you know, this is all a distraction from the path, not the path. And it says, you know, basically, if you really want to encounter the Buddha face to face, the Buddha's wisdom or Buddha mind face to face, enlightenment, you need to go. You need to walk the walk. You need to walk the Buddha's walk. You need to follow the Buddha's marga, his path. And the Buddha's path began with not knowing, not knowing, not knowing. See. So, you know, when you read biographies of the Buddha, like the Lalita Vistara Sutra, this beautiful Mahayana biography of the Buddha. You know, when the Buddha's born, there's already angels. You know, there's all these heavenly beings are there. Everybody knows this guy's the future Buddha. But you know, actually, it wasn't like that for the Buddha. He didn't know he was going to be the Buddha. You know, he left home not knowing what he was looking for. He just knew that everybody he loved was going to die. And that troubled him enormously. Everything I care about is going to die. You know, people are, you know, the fear of death is really fundamental motivation for human beings, really. And they pretend it's not, but you know, I was reading this guy the other day. He said all of culture is really an attempt to stave off oblivion. All these beautiful music, beautiful art, it's all an attempt to hide from ourselves the fact that we are not going to exist forever. And you know, the Buddha said, "Oh, you know, we're not going to exist forever. What am I going to do about that? What are we supposed to do about that?" And he sets off on the path, right? And every step was uncertain. The Buddha was determined not to just know intellectually, but to know in his flesh and his, as we say in Zen, in his Zen flesh and his Zen bones. And what does it mean to know something in your Zen flesh and your Zen bones? It means to sit down the way we are doing and drop into deep samadhi and into the samadhi of shunyata, into mushin. And then we start experiencing the world in this different way, no longer tethered, no longer tied to self, the fantasy of self, right? It's like this is how we travel, just like the Buddha traveled. And you know, the problem is that all human beings, according to the Dharma, seek to protect themselves from that uncertainty using ideas and images and so on and so on. And, you know, we gradually close off the mystery. We gradually close off our Buddha nature. We wrap ourselves like a caterpillar in a cocoon of ideas and rituals and, beautiful images and so on. and we insulate ourselves from the world around us. And, you know, even Buddhists can do this, actually, right? Even Buddhists can do this. You know, anybody can buy a mala and put it around her wrist or his wrist. Anybody can buy a Buddha and have it on the desk at work, you know, or at home. But, you know, that's devotion to the Buddha or reverence to the Buddha. But following the Buddha's path is quite a different thing. And Zen said, let's do what the Buddha did and not simply admire the teachings at a distance, right? Because how do we even know they're true? See, so even being willing to test them out and see if they're true is so important. And by the way, that's what the Buddha said to do in the Kalama Sutra. He said, don't take it on faith, test it out. So this is, Zen is a protest, a rebellion against what was really killing Buddhism in China. Buddhism brought back in, Zen brought back into Buddhism, don't know. Be in not knowing, be in uncertainty, right? And when you're in uncertainty, when you're really in deep emptiness, all these things that you thought you understood, you realize you never understood. So, you know, basically, I could tell you so many stories, you know. You see your brother twice a year on holidays. It's just your brother. You know, it's a Thanksgiving. You give him a hug. You talk about your families. You watch the football game. And then you say goodbye. You know, see you down the shore, you know, in the summer. And then it's Thanksgiving again. You know, and one day you're sitting on the cushion, right? And you're in deep emptiness. And you're working on your koan, and suddenly you think of your brother. And you see your brother, and he's 4 years old, and he's crying in the bedroom. And, you know, you realize how much you love this person, and how much you're going to miss him when he's gone. And you realize how isolated he's been all his life. And then you realize how isolated you've been all your life, right? And it's like this person who was just your brother, just Bill, you know, suddenly there's like this insight, you know, this 5-year-old kid sobbing in his bedroom. And you now begin to know who he is. Now you begin to know who he is, right? It's like all the wrapping paper, you know, we wrap everybody up in paper. We say he's my brother, that's right, wrapping paper. We say he's a Democrat, that's wrapping paper. We say he's an accountant, that's wrapping paper. You know, but when we come to do Zen, we tear the paper away. And sometimes it's your heart. You know, it really tugs at your heart. See, and Buddhism is not about not having anything tug at your heart. Buddhism is about tearing off the wrapping paper. What are you afraid of? You know, see, if you're afraid to tear the wrapping paper off, that's not wisdom, that's fear. So we tear the wrapping paper off. Now you have a real encounter with your brother, right? Or it's possible to have a real encounter. So you know, we Zen people, we believe in not knowing. You know, even if you've been doing Zen for 50 years, if you're practicing Zen, you know, it's the most valuable moments at any sesshin are the moments when you don't know what you're doing, when you're lost, and you're uncertain. And now you can discover, you know, what life is really like when you tear away all the wrapping paper, all the ideas, and all the concepts, right? And you're just there in the moment, awake, you know, and observing with your mind empty and blank. That's the Buddha's way. That's how he achieved enlightenment. You know, we believe that the Buddha woke up when he was in the highest jhana. In the highest jhana, you can't even distinguish between consciousness and the absence of consciousness. So he was in the highest jhana, and then he noticed the morning star after meditating all night. And that's when he had his great awakening. So he was in the deepest formlessness, and then he turned his attention back to form, and that's when he had his daikensho, his great awakening. So that's the method of Zen, is to go into deep emptiness and then return to the world of form. And you see the world of form, you know, it suddenly comes to life, this world that has been made so dead by routine, by the wrapping paper, right? So this young monk, I trained with Takabayashi Genki Roshi, and then later with Kangan Glenn Webb. And I was working on the Mu Koan for like 3 years. I kept going into Dokusan, and I could, you know, the Roshi wanted us to call Mu. You know about this, you go in and you call Gomu. And for 3 years, I couldn't open my mouth. It was just like, I could not open my mouth. One time I went to a sesshin, and I went through the whole sesshin, and when I came into the Dokusan room, I just couldn't. I said, I can't do it. I can't call. Why couldn't I call Mu? It's so easy. It's just a mechanical procedure. You just open your mouth and call Mu. But on the deepest level of my being, I was blocked. I was blocked. I could not trust my big mind. And it was like about a year later, when I'd really given up, that I went into the Dokusan room and I called Mu. It was just wonderful. It's like giving birth to a baby. It was so wonderful. I haven't given birth, but I imagine it's something like that. It was just like energy flowing through my body. So, you know, years later, I had a chance to study with another teacher. And he said, I introduced myself, and I went into the Dokusan room, and he said, let's do Mu. We did some koans, and he said, let's do Mu together. And I said, oh, I've already done Mu. He said, I know, but let's do Mu together. So I started calling Mu. And at this place, everybody would scream Mu in the morning really loudly. And it was like I blew out one of my vocal cords. I called Mu so loudly. And when I went in to talk, you know, to call Mu, I'd start calling, and it was like my vocal cord would give out. And it was just like dead air coming out of my mouth. And, I sat in deep mushin, and when I went in to see this teacher, when I presented Mu, it was totally different response. It was just like totally different. You know, I thought I had understood Mu, but I didn't understand Mu at all until I went in and gave him that response. So the problem was that I had wrapped Mu in wrapping paper, right? I've done Mu. I know the answer to the Mu koan. It's not about knowing, right? It's not about knowing, it's about cutting through our mental structures and experiencing the thing itself, right? Main subject, Kyozan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" "Mount Rozan," answered the monk. "Have you ever visited Goroho Peak?" asked Kyozan. "No, not yet," said the monk. Kyozan said, "You have not visited Rozan. Have you? You've been there, but you haven't been to the peak, so you haven't been there." Later, Umon said, "This talk of Kyozan's was falling into the weeds out of kindness." Secho's verse, "Falling or not falling, who can tell? White clouds piling up, bright sun shining down. Faultless the left, mature the right. Don't you know cold mountain?" Kanzan here is cold. "Don't you know cold mountain? He went very fast, 10 years not returning. He forgot the way he had come." So cold mountain was this monk who, even among Zen monks, he was, you know, kind of fed up with formalization. And he went and lived in the mountains, just like a wild man. And did his zazen day after day. And you know, basically he said, I it's no longer possible for me to go home. He doesn't mean because I'm lost in the wilderness. He meant, you know, I live in uncertainty. Every day it's a new world for me. And every day is a new world for us when we can cultivate deep mushin. Even if we've done this a million times, it's like every day is a new day if you really drop body and mind and enter that emptiness.